started to load a casement with a sugar and potassium nitrate mix. It was too granular to attempt to put a spindle hole down the middle, so I poured it in and tapped on the casement to settle the grain as best I could. Dad caught me at it as he came in from work. "What now, little man?"
"New propellant, sir."
"If it went off, how high would this house come off its foundation?"
"Only a foot or two."
"Attaboy," he said, and then kept going. Startled, I turned and watched him go up the steps.
Attaboy?
The following Saturday, the BCMA gathered and went down to the Cape for a test. This launch wasn't advertised because we had no idea how our new propellant of saltpeter and sugar would work. Auk 9 took off with a satisfying hiss, but it quickly died and fell with a plop not more than 100 feet from the pad. We recovered it and carried it back to the blockhouse to consider it. When I tapped it, a little debris fell out. Most of the propellant had burned. Sherman sniffed at it.
"It smells like candy."
"Rocket candy," Odell chimed, and so coined our new term for the propellant. We launched again the following weekend. I had wet the potassium nitrate and sugar mix to keep it from burning too fast and packed it inside a standard casement. A new member of the BCMA joined us. His name was Billy, a boy in our class who lived up Snake Root Hollow. Other boys occasionally expressed an interest in joining us, but Billy was the first one who took it upon himself to persist in asking. I was glad to have him. Billy was a good runner, which, considering the range we hoped to attain, I thought we might need to help us find our rockets. He was also smart, smarter than me if his grades were any evidence. Auk 10 sat on the pad and fizzled, producing some white smoke and just enough thrust to rock it gently on its fins. We inspected it afterwards, a black caramel-like liquid oozing from it. Quentin decided that sugar was too soluble. The fuel was too wet. Auk 11, which had rocket candy inside that I had not moistened, leaped off the pad with a satisfying hiss, but then exploded, steel fragments whistling overhead while we hit the dirt inside the blockhouse. We crept outside and stood around the pad. The steel casement was turned back like a banana peel. Quentin, as usual, had an explanation ready. "My speculation is the propellant collapsed. When the rocket took off, the propellant was so loose it just fell inward. Too much of it burned at once." We went back and looked at the first rocket. The batter that dripped out had hardened. I dug at it with a stick. "There's no way this could fall inward." Sherman poked at it, too. "But that's been melted. I wonder if it would still burn." To find out, we took a chunk of it to the pad and lit it. It sputtered and then burst into flame. Sherman said what we were all thinking. "What if we melted rocket candy before loading it into the casement?" After some anxious moments with a hot plate and a number of ruined kitchen pots, we succeeded in melting enough rocket candy to load Auk 12. Thanks to the newspaper articles, there were about 50 spectators at the next launch. I hoped we wouldn't disappoint them. How Auk 12 would perform with melted rocket candy was a complete unknown. I feared an explosion, and Quentin was certain of it. Sherman went over to the road to make sure people knew they needed to stay back, and it would be best if they got behind their cars and trucks. Our audience was festive. "Go, Big Creek," some people called out, just like we were the football team. Then, when we ran up our BCMA flag, they began to sing the school fight song. "On, on, green and white, we are ripe for the fight tonight. Hold that ball and hit that line, every Big Creek star will shine." I had never known what it felt like to be on the receiving end of that song. I liked it. This was also our first launch with an electrical ignition system. I touched a wire to a car battery, and Auk 12 shot off the pad and leaned downrange. Quentin ran outside the bunker and fumbled with a new invention he called a theodolite, a product of our trigonometry studies and Jake's advice. It was a broomstick with an upside-down protractor attached on one end and a wooden straight edge on the opposing side that rotated around a nail. He jammed the stick in the slack and went down on his knees and squinted along the straight edge at the rising rocket, smoke squirming from its tail, white against the brilliant blue of the cloudless sky. At the height of the Auk's climb, Quentin looked at the angle the ruler made with the protractor and called it out, and then snatched a pencil stuck behind his ear and wrote it down on a scrap of paper. If his theodolite worked, trigonometry would give us the altitude of our rocket. Auk-12's exhaust trail was still a fast stream when the rocket faltered and began to fall. It continued to smoke vigorously even after it struck the slack. While our audience cheered, we ran after our rocket and watched the last of its sputtering rocket candy burn up. I immediately saw the reason our rocket had lost its thrust. The nozzle's gone. It must have blown out. We looked closer. The weld was intact. The center of the nozzle was simply eaten away. Quentin came stepping up to us, finishing his count by bringing both feet together at the final step. 348. I'm figuring about 2.75 feet per step. That would be, he made a quick mental calculation, 957 feet. Jake's trig book was under his arm. He ran his finger down the functions in the back. Let's see, the tangent of 40 degrees is about 0.84. Call it 0.8. Multiply that by 960. We waited anxiously while Quentin worked it out in his head. It didn't take long. 760 feet. Odell whooped and did a little jig on the slack. Auk-13 jumped from the pad in a similar blurred frenzy to its predecessor. Rocket candy was definitely hot stuff. The rocket leaned over, puffed a big cloud of smoke, and sped off into the sky. When it fell back, it disappeared into a dense thicket of trees. We heard it hit branches as it fell, a big oak tree waving its golden leaves at us as if signaling, "Come and get it! Rocket over here!" Odell knocked over Quentin's theodolite in his excitement, so we didn't get an altitude estimate, but it was obvious it hadn't gone as high as Auk-12. When we found the rocket, the nozzle was completely worn through. I studied the nozzle. "You know what? It looks to me like it's corroded." Quentin snapped his fingers. "Rapid oxidation, of course. I should have seen it myself, just like in Miss Riley's class. Heat combined with a steady flow of excessive oxygen. It makes sense. What we need, gentlemen, is a material capable of withstanding heat and oxidation." On Sunday morning, I pretended to oversleep. Dad had come into my room a couple of days earlier and surprised me by starting a conversation about my wanting to be an engineer. I told him that I wasn't really sure what an engineer was, but I was sure that I wanted to work on rockets. He'd responded that real engineers didn't waste time on rockets. They built things that people could use and that would help make money for their companies. To show me what he meant, he'd offered to take me someplace I'd never been before, someplace that Mom wouldn't hear of me going. So I faked sleeping in and waited till Mom and Jim left for church. Then I got up, got dressed, and walked up the path to the tipple where Dad waited for me. I was almost shaking with excitement. I'd lived in Colwood my whole life, but had never been where Dad was going to take me. I was going in the mine. And the fact he'd asked me, not Jim, had grown even more important through the week whenever I thought about it. He eyed me carefully when I came into his office. "You didn't say a word about this to your mother, did you?" My answer was loud and proud.
"No, sir."
"Right. Well, you get washed up afterward, and she won't ever know the difference." He spread a map of the mine on a table and beckoned me over. He pointed at a winding black streak that ran across the map. "That's the No. 4 Pocahontas seam, the finest and purest soft coal in the world. These lines I've drawn represent the tunnels we've driven through it since the mine has been operational." He opened a drawer and brought out another drawing. "This is the side view of a typical seam. The coal is overlaid by a hard shale called draw rock. Underneath is what we call jack rock. Engineers have to know how to hold up the draw rock to keep it from falling and how to move the jack rock out of the way." Dad searched my eyes while he spoke. I think he was looking for a glimmer of understanding. "Doing the engineering in a mine takes a lot of experience and careful calculations. Men who work under those roofs depend on the mining engineers to do it right the first time. It's not like your rocket men, those crazy German scientists just throwing something up to see if it will work." I resisted the urge to answer that charge, and Dad lectured on. The coal company used the block system, he said, each block being 75 feet by 90 feet. Entries were driven through them in sets of four. After that, the blocks were taken out by continuous mining machines, one by one, until each of them was only about 15 feet square. Those remaining blocks were called pillars, which were also eventually mined. During all of it, roof bolts and posts and cribs all had to be calculated and set to hold the roof up. Then Dad got off into his favorite subject, ventilating air through the mine. If the air stops circulating, methane will seep out of the coal and build up. One spark and the whole mine could explode. To keep that from happening, we use a pressure system. Fans raise the pressure in the mine to a little greater than the surface pressure. The methane is blown out through the vents. I was impressed.
You designed that?
He glanced down at his drawings. I did a good portion of it. I was confused on this point.
So you're an engineer?
He toyed with a slide rule. No, sonny, you have to have a diploma from a college to be an engineer. I don't have one. That means I can never be an engineer. He looked at me speculatively.
But you could.
Dad led me to the bathhouse and opened his locker and handed me a one-piece coverall, hard-toe boots, a white foreman's helmet, and a leather utility belt. When I joined him at the man hoist, he showed me how to clip a lamp battery pack onto my belt and the lamp on my helmet. With the lamp attached, the helmet felt heavy. I moved it around until it felt comfortable. He appraised me and readjusted the helmet and then my belt until the buckle was squared in the front and the battery hanging exactly off my right hip. I felt like a soldier under inspection. The attendant swung the gate aside, and for the first time in my life, I stepped onto the wooden plank platform of the lift. I thought of all the times when I was a small child and had watched the miners descend into the darkness. Now it was my turn. I could feel my heart speed up. The boards in the floor were set apart enough that I could see between them. There was nothing beneath us but a dark chasm. I had a momentary twinge of fear that we were going to fall. The bell rang three times, announcing that we were about to be let down. I took a deep, ragged breath. The man-hoist winch began to creak and the lift dropped quickly, my stomach lifting up around my throat. I grabbed Dad's arm, then quickly let it go in embarrassment. He said nothing, and I watched the solid rock of the shaft slip past. Men had hand-dug the shaft, but I couldn't imagine how. It had taken me and the boys all day just to dig out a little place for our blockhouse at Cape Colwood. Through the gaps in the floor, I started to see lights far below. Above us, the square of light at the top of the shaft had shrunk to a tiny twinkling star. We were being swallowed by the earth, and I hadn't decided yet whether I liked that. When we neared the bottom, the lift slowed, jerked a few times, and then settled level with a rock platform. I switched on my helmet light. There were miners waiting on the platform. Mr. Dubonnet was among them. He looked at me with surprise.
A new hire, Homer? He'll need to join the union.
Dad snapped back.
Sonny's thinking about becoming a mining engineer, a company man.
Solid gray walls surrounded us. I felt almost as if I was on some alien planet. All the things I'd ever known that oriented me, trees, the sky, the mountains, none of them were around. The air even smelled different, like wet gunpowder. Off to the right was a set of tracks with a big yellow electric locomotive sitting on it, some cars behind. I could see a connecting tunnel to the left, the blue haze of fluorescent lights showing through a window in a concrete block building. Hot white flashes and rapid hisses within indicated arc welding. Dad saw me looking.
We put a little machine shop down here. Saves time bringing out equipment that needs repair.
Is Mr. Bykovsky in there? At my question, Dad rocked on his hard-toe boots.
Ike's not a machinist anymore, sonny. He's a loader, and a damn good one.
He stepped forward.
Come on, let's get on down the line.
Dad led me to the locomotive, stopping to talk to its operator.
I recognized him, Mr. Weaver, whose son Harry was 5 grades ahead of me. Dad nodded a brisk hello. Take us all the way to the face, Frank.
You got it.
Dad took me to an attached car he called a man trip. It was a low-slung steel car with 2 hard metal benches inside that faced each other. We crawled inside the man trip and sat side by side facing forward. Dad slapped the top to let Mr. Weaver know we were ready to go. The man trip lurched and we were off, plunging down what seemed an endless black tunnel. Dad said we were on the main line. For 20 minutes the rails clacked beneath us, the posts holding up the rock roof blurring past us like a subterranean forest of gray tree trunks. On straightaways, the locomotive roared as we flew down the track, the man trip rattling and shaking. I could smell the hot odor of the locomotive's electric motor. Before we got to a curve, Mr. Weaver applied the brakes and the steel wheels of the locomotive and our man trip squealed like 1,000 tortured pigs. I held the steel seat with my hands between my legs so I wouldn't fall over when we took the curves. As we sped along, I occasionally saw the flash of miners' lamps down branching tunnels, but it was too dark to see what they were doing. At my question about them, Dad said they were dusting, spreading rock dust around to hold down the explosive mixture of coal dust and air. It registered on me after a time that the mine was not the cold, dank, ugly place I'd always imagined it to be. The air was cool and dry, and when we stopped at a switch to let a line of low coal cars go past us, I peered down the tunnel, and the mica in the rock wall sparkled like diamonds. I remembered then that Dad had once brought some mica crystals home with him and left them on the kitchen table for Mom along with a card that said, "You always wanted diamonds, but these are the best I can do. I wish they were real." The next morning, waiting for him on the table was Mom's note of reply. "I never wanted diamonds. I only wanted a little of your time. That's still all I want." But she didn't throw Dad's diamonds away. I knew. I had come across them in the notes while looking for some writing paper in her desk. When the man trip stopped, Dad jumped out. "We've got an operation going at the face today, Sonny. I want you to see it." When I climbed out, I stood up and slammed my helmet into the roof so hard it almost knocked me to my knees. I staggered and then looked up to see what I had hit and saw slabs of rock, roof bolts jammed into them every few feet. Dad ignored my trouble and took off at a fast pace, never looking back. I took off after him, my helmet whapping against the roof in a painful staccato. Every time I thought I had found a rhythm to my walk, I hit my head again. Once I hit a header so hard it knocked me off my feet. I landed on my back, my helmet flying, saved only by the lamp cord attached to the battery on my belt. I scrambled after it. By the time I got my helmet back on, Dad had disappeared around a turn. I could see the jumping reflections of his lamp on a far wall. I hurried after him, my helmet still knocking against the roof. I was developing a powerful crick in my neck. Pretty soon, he was so far ahead of me, I knew I would never catch up. I was close to panic. What if I got lost? If my lamp went out, nobody would ever find me again. Then I heard a noise, like the mine was tearing itself apart. I felt like running away, but where would I go? I turned a corner, and I beheld an astonishingly huge machine. Spotlights bolted to its side, tearing at a wall of coal. Dad was off to the side, watching it. He saw me and waved me over, yelling over the roar, "That's a continuous mining machine!" It looked to me more like some kind of great prehistoric animal. Dad positioned me out of the way when a shuttle car darted in, its crab-like arms sweeping up the coal thrown out behind the continuous miner. When the shuttle was full, it backed off, dragging a thick electrical umbilical behind it. I realized this was the kind of vehicle Mr. Bykovsky had been assigned to. I looked closer to see if it was him, but the operator was Mr. Kirk, the father of Wanda, a girl in a class behind mine. Wanda had a great voice and sang in the school choir. Mr. Kirk made a run to the track to unload his shuttle into a waiting coal car. The noise was deafening. Dad yelled into my ear, explaining what I was seeing. The miner was working a block, he said, sloughing off the coal until all that was left was a pillar. An engineer has to study the rock above these pillars. If weight becomes concentrated on one of them, it'll explode. The last time that happened, it tore one of our shuttles to pieces. I looked at Mr. Kirk's shuttle as it returned and tried to imagine the power it would take to tear such a machine apart. I wondered what had happened to the driver of the shuttle and started to ask, but Dad interrupted my train of thought with a sweep of his hand around the busy workplace.
This is real engineering work, sonny.
The foreman of the work party saw us and came over. The black face under the white foreman's helmet was my Uncle Robert, Mom's brother. He looked at me quizzically and nodded at Dad.
How's Elsie? Fine, Bob, fine. But does she know Sonny's down here?
I wouldn't take him anywhere he's not safe, Bob. That's all that matters. Uncle Robert cocked an eyebrow.
I wonder if his mom would agree with that. Just let me worry about Elsie.
Dad and Uncle Robert started discussing business and I wandered away, trying to get a better angle on watching the continuous miner and the shuttle go through their choreographed dance of mining coal. Uncle Robert came and got me, shaking his head.
That's not a good place to stand, sonny.
He carried a 3-foot wooden pole with him and used it to poke at the ceiling. A big, jagged rock came loose and hit the floor with a heavy thump right where I had been standing. I jumped and whapped my helmet once more against the roof. How my neck hurt. Uncle Robert chuckled.
Man has to be thinking every second down here, sonny.
I positioned myself where Uncle Robert pointed, under a roof bolt, and kept watching until Dad led me back to the man trip. As we trundled back down the main line, I was thinking about all that I had seen. I couldn't wait to tell the boys, but then I thought I couldn't do that. This was supposed to be a secret. I was worrying how I was going to get around that when Dad suddenly started to talk.
I love the mine. I love everything about it. I love getting up in the morning before sunrise and walking up the path to the tipple. I love seeing the shifts change, the men bunching up at the man hoist ready to go to work.
I listened, amazed, not that he was saying what he was saying, but that he would share such thoughts with me. I felt proud, grown up. Dad took off his helmet and rubbed his head, scratching around it where the sides of the helmet had pressed in his hair. When he started to talk again, I focused on his every word as if they were gold coins he was dropping into my hand, one by one.
I love going to the face. I go every day even though I don't have to. That's where I see if my plan for the day is working. I see it all in my head days before, see the cut the continuous miners will take, the route of the loaders, the roof bolts going in, the places where the methane might build up and where the foreman needs to check with his safety lamp. It's all there when I arrive, just as I saw it, and I get great satisfaction from that.
I found that I was staring at him, the narrow beam of my lamp focused on his face like a spotlight on an actor.
Every day I meet with Mr. Van Dyke and his engineers. Even though I don't have a diploma, I know more than they do because I've been to the face and they haven't. I've ridden the man trip down the main line, got out and walked back into the gob and felt the air pressure on my face. I know the mine like I know a man, can sense things about it that aren't right even when everything on paper says it is. Every day there's something that needs to be done, because men will be hurt if it isn't done, or the coal the company's promised to load won't get loaded. Coal is the lifeblood of this country. If we fail, steel fails, and then the country fails.
The beam from his helmet lamp shone in my eyes.
There's no men in the world like miners, sonny. They're good men, strong men, the best there is. I think no matter what you do with your life, no matter where you go or who you know, you will never know such good and strong men.
Then he turned so his lamp shined down a side cut, the lamps of his men flashing back from the darkness as if they knew he was passing.
You're my boy. I was born to lead men in the profession of mining coal. Maybe you were too.
You're my boy. In the dark, I could savor the words without embarrassment. After the man trip got back to the bottom of the shaft, Dad led me to the lift. The cage was beneath us, the shaft a little deeper than the main level.
He pushed a brass button, and a bell rang, and the cage came up. Dad pushed the bell twice more, and we stepped aboard. A miner came out of the little cement blockhouse, and at Dad's nod, pushed the bell three times. We started up at a good clip. About 100 feet up the shaft, the lift suddenly stopped. I looked around worriedly. The ragged cut rock surrounding us seemed to close in. All I could see above us was a tiny spark of sunlight. I noticed a detail I hadn't seen before, a set of steel steps. At my question, Dad said they went all the way from the top of the shaft to the bottom. There was a gap between the lift and the steps. To get on them would require taking a step over the oblivion of the deep hole beneath us. At that prospect, my heart sped up and my hands started to sweat. Dad seemed to sense my unease. "Don't fret, they're probably just greasing the hoist." We stood quietly for a long minute. Then Dad asked, "So what do you think about the mine?" I knew what he wanted me to say, and it was tempting to say it, but I also didn't want to lie to him. I considered my answer and settled on the kind of evasive response I used on my mother over the years. "I learned a lot," I said, and left it at that. Dad wasn't fooled. "What I'm asking you is, do you want to be a mining engineer? If you do, I'll pay your way through school." I carefully crafted my answer. "I'd like to be an engineer." But Dad pressed. "A mining engineer?" He had me. I had no choice but to tell him the truth. "I want to go to work for Dr. von Braun, Dad." He didn't hide his disappointment. It was written clearly on his face. The lift jerked, and once more we started up. I glumly watched the rock slide past. I had really messed up this time. Dad was not only mad at me, I knew I'd hurt him, too. I should have never agreed to go down in the mine. I knew what Dad was likely to be getting at, and I knew I wasn't going to agree to it. So why had I gone along with it? I was a stupid kid sometime, no doubt about it. As we neared the surface, the cold, fresh air off the mountain blew down the shaft, giving me a shiver. The Earth's surface slipped past, and there, standing at the gate still in her church clothes, was my mother. A rock dust crew stood nearby, their eyes locked on her. They shifted their gaze to Dad and me. Mom stared at what I knew must be my grimy face, my coal-mascared eyes, and my blackened coveralls. Then, to my utter astonishment, she burst into tears. The rock dust crew took a step backward. Some of them took off their helmets, rubbing their heads and looking down at their feet as if embarrassed to be witness to her tears. Dad tried to shush her as he unlatched the lift gate.
"Stop it, Elsie. You're scaring the men."
I tried, too. "Everything's fine, Mom." But my stomach was bottoming out. We were about to have a family argument right here in front of God and everybody. I couldn't imagine anything more embarrassing. Dad gestured toward me.
"He's thinking about being a mining engineer, Elsie."
Mom's tears seemed to dry up instantly, as if they'd been sucked back inside her. "Over my dead body." Dad pushed me ahead.
"Go take a shower."
He looked around at the men still ducking their heads but watching all the same.
"This is none of your business."
The rock dust crew moved off only a couple of feet so they could keep listening. I walked to the wash house but stopped at the door. Even though I was so mortified I wanted to disappear, I wanted to hear, too. Mr. Dubonnet, wearing his miner's helmet with his street clothes, stepped outside and saw what was happening. He crossed his arms and leaned against the wall, chuckling. I didn't know what he thought was so blamed funny. Dad reached to take Mom's arm.
"What the devil's wrong with you, Elsie?"
She pulled back.
"This mine's killed you, but it's not going to kill my boys."
"You're talking nonsense."
She poked a finger at his chest.
"Black spot about the size of a dime. Doc told me. Here on the right side."
She poked him again, hard. Dad huffed a near laugh, reached down for a handful of coal dust, and tossed it in the air. He took a deep breath of it.
"I thrive on this stuff. It's like mother's milk to me."
Mom watched the dust settle around him. Some of it blew in her face, sticking to her makeup, but she didn't flinch. She turned and marched inside the wash house where I had retreated,
sending naked miners scrambling for towels. She grabbed me by my arm and growled, "You can wash at home." As we came out, Mr. Dubonnet tipped his helmet to her, but all he got in return was a dirty look. The rock dust crew scattered before her. Only Dad stood his ground, his helmet in his hand. He watched us pass without comment. All the way down the path from the tipple, I could feel his eyes boring into the back of my head. The next week, Quentin caught the school bus to Colwood, and we went to the big machine shop. Mr. Leon Farrow, who ran the shop, waved us in his office, reared back in his chair, and put his boots up on his desk.
"I heard you were coming. Let's hear what you're after."
"What we were after," I said, "was some kind of steel for our nozzles that could withstand heat, pressure, and oxidation. The steel we've been using burns up."
"Sounds like it also needs to be thicker."
Mr. Farrow had taken a pencil and, for no apparent reason, was balancing it on his upper lip. He rocked his head, working to keep the pencil from slipping off. I was mesmerized by his trick.
"Yes, sir, we think at least an inch thick. We need a hole drilled through its center, too."
Mr. Farrow stuck the pencil behind his ear.
"SAE 1020 bar stock ought to do you fine. 1020 has a high melting point and good tensile strength, too. Expensive stuff, though. Take some time to drill and shape. Come on."
Quentin and I followed him through the shop, his machinists busy at their drill presses and milling machines and lathes. When we caught their eye, they stopped long enough to grin and wave at us.
"Rocket boys," they mouthed to one another over the drone of their machines.
Mr. Farrow stopped at a workbench and picked up a tap and threading tool.
"I'd recommend inserting machine screws around the diameter of your thing to hold it in place. What did you call it?"
"A nozzle." He nodded and took the pencil from behind his ear and pulled out a sheet of paper from the bench. Then he handed me the pencil.
"Draw me what you need."
I drew parallel lines to represent the casement and then showed the plug at the top and the nozzle at the bottom, with a hole about a third of the diameter drilled through it. Mr. Farrow perused my effort.
"Sonny, if you want work done in this shop, you're going to have to give me an engineering drawing. I'll need not only this side view, but also a top view and a detail on the plug and the nozzle. Think you can do that if I give you an example to follow?"
"Yes, sir, I can." Except for winning Dorothy, which still remained my unsolvable puzzle, I figured I could do pretty much anything I wanted to do if only I worked at it hard enough. Mr. Leon Farrow, I quickly learned, didn't do anything for free. In exchange for machining our rocket casing, he wanted gravel to fill a sinkhole in his yard. To get the gravel, we had to execute several interim trades involving lumber, a new commode, and some steel tubing. But in the end, Mr. Farrow got his gravel, and we got our casing. AUK 14 was heavy, and there wasn't much room for the propellant after the nozzle and top plug were bolted in place. The fins and nose cone would add more to the weight. I doubted even rocket candy could get this dense little rocket off the ground. Quentin regarded the rocket.
"What needs to be done is to increase the volume of the cylinder with only a small amount of additional mass."
I translated. "It needs to be longer." A machinist, Clinton Caton was his name, raised his hand.
"I'll do it, boss."
Mr. Farrow nodded agreement. Mr. Caton, as it turned out, was a man of vision. Without any advice from me, he lengthened the rocket to 2.5 feet, a monster. To fill it took a pot and a half of rocket candy. While the candy was still soft, I pushed a glass rod into it, borrowed from Miss Riley's lab supplies, forming a spindle hole. The following weekend, our rocket rocked in the stiff, frigid wind that swept over Cape Colwood, enough so I was afraid it might be blown over. Sherman and Billy dragged out a 6-foot steel rod Odell had found discarded behind the machine shop and jammed it into the slack beside the pad. We used a wrap of wire to make a loop at the top and bottom of the rocket and then slid it down the rod. Mr. Farrow's machinist crowded around, braving the bitter wind. Jake and Mr. Dubonnet were there, too. After we got everyone safe in the blockhouse or hiding behind their cars, AUK 14 erupted from the pad, spinning once around the rod before hurtling into the sky.
Quentin threw himself out of the blockhouse with his theodolite and started tracking. Sherman limped outside, scribbling notes on the flight. It angled slightly over in the direction of what we called Rocket Mountain and kept climbing. It was our best rocket yet. When it was just a dot against the blue sky, it stopped and came hurtling down, disappearing behind the highest ridge on Rocket Mountain. We took off, scrambling up through the woods. Billy was in the lead. He was not only a good runner, but had a great nose for burnt rocket candy. A whole hour later, tired, our knees bloody from battering them against the rocks we had to climb, we found AUK 14. It had landed nose first, full bore, against the only rock outcropping within 100 yards. Its casement was bent, and its nose cone turned to sawdust. At least the nozzle was intact. There was erosion and pitting within, but it had held up. Quentin finally gasped up beside us. Even Sherman could move faster through the woods than he could. He paused, his hands on his knees, trying to get his breath. Then he thumbed through Jake's trigonometry book. 3,000 feet! Roy Lee whooped. I think we better give those boys a call down at Cape Canaveral. We could teach them a thing or two. The machinists waved me into their shop a week later to show off a rocket that they had built on their own. It followed the last design, except it was 6 inches longer, a 3-footer. They had also put in the top plug and the nozzle with machine screws rather than welding them. Eye bolts were attached on the top and bottom for the guide rod. I accepted it gratefully, and the boys and I dragged out the hot plate and filled it up. The following weekend, AUK 15 drilled into the sky to the applause of the watching machinists. I could tell it wasn't going to go as high as the smaller AUK 14. In fact, it managed only half the altitude. Although the machinists were still thrilled by it, Quentin and I worried over its performance all week, trying to figure out what had cut into its altitude. We may have reached the maximum performance with rocket candy. Perhaps there's a break-even point for all propellants. I shook my head. We need more tests, and we still need a book so we'll know what we're talking about. Quentin shrugged. If we keep going the way we are, we can write our own book. During one of our study sessions in late November, I worked up the courage to ask Dorothy to the Christmas formal. She shook her head sadly. I wish I could. That boy I went out with last summer asked me, and I told him yes. That boy I knew was a college student from Welch. Dorothy had told me all about him. But you said he was mean to you. How could you agree to go out with him again? Well, he asked me before I realized what kind of boy he was. And you're still going to the formal with him? She sighed. I told him I would, and I can't go back on my promise. But I'll be thinking of you, Sonny. I will. The way she looked at me so pitifully, I couldn't help but feel sorry for her. The night of the big dance, I suffered at home, barely paying attention to the book, Steinbeck's Sweet Thursday, I had borrowed from Dad's bookcase in the upstairs hall. I stayed awake until 2 o'clock in the morning, relaxing only when I was certain Dorothy must be home and safe. I saw Roy Lee the next day. He'd been to the formal, and I couldn't resist asking him if he'd seen Dorothy. Roy Lee looked past me off into the distance. What do you want me to say? Well, the truth. Roy Lee put his hand on my shoulder. She was all over that guy. Christmas 1958 wasn't a white one, but it was bitterly cold. No problem in a town sitting on 1 billion tons of the finest bituminous coal in the world. As always, Mom bought the biggest tree in town, and Jim and I wrestled it indoors for her. Unwilling to remove an inch off it, Mom made us wedge it against the ceiling at an angle. When Dad came home, he silently got his stepladder out and cut 2 feet off the top. Mom hated his handiwork, saying he'd made it look more like a bush than a tree. On Christmas morning, Mom came into my room and sat on my bed, handing over a large manila envelope. Not having any idea what it might contain, I opened it, and to my amazement, found an autographed photograph of Dr. Wernher von Braun with a personal note in his own handwriting. I couldn't believe what I was reading. He was congratulating me on the success with my rockets, suggesting that I continue my education
and perhaps I might one day find a job in the space business. The note ended by saying, if you work hard enough, you will do anything you want. I stared at the photo, and then the note, going from one to the other. I couldn't believe I was touching these things that the great man had also touched.
Mom, how...
She grinned, a little proud of herself, I think. I wrote him about you, Sonny. I thought he'd like to know who was getting ready to come help him build his rockets. I grabbed her around her neck and gave her a big hug, surprising her as much as me. I had never had such a wonderful present. For the remainder of the Christmas break, I read and reread Von Braun's note. I carried the Von Braun photo and letter to school the first day back after Christmas. At lunch in the auditorium, Quentin fingered them like they were holy artifacts. Prodigious, he whispered in reverence and awe. One night in January, it started to snow, a little at first and then steadily. Before I crawled into bed, I heard the muffled footsteps of the hoot owl miners trudging through the deepening snow. The next morning, I crawled out of bed to silence. Nothing was moving outside except walking miners. Johnny Villani made the announcement. The schools were open, but the buses weren't running. If students could walk to school, they were expected to go. The rest of us had the day off. I went into the living room for a rare treat, to watch the Today Show all the way through. But I got barely a glimpse of J. Fred Muggs before a snowball hit the living room window. When I looked out, I saw Odell, Roy Lee, and Sherman with sleds. Jim and a knot of his friends had already grabbed their sleds and headed to Colwood Central to test the road between the church and the clubhouse. Come on! Odell was so excited he was bouncing up and down. We're going to Big Creek. Nobody's ever done that before on sleds. We're going to be the first ones ever. Mom was sipping coffee in front of her tropical beach. The palm tree was done, and it looked like she was adding coconuts to it. Mom, we're going to sled all the way to Big Creek. Well, don't freeze to death. I trotted down the basement steps, found my sled, and pitched it outside. Then I went back to my room and put on another pair of jeans, an undershirt, and a thick flannel shirt over it, two pairs of socks, my galoshes, and a heavy wool coat. No hat. It was not the style of teenaged West Virginia boys to wear a hat, except the black felt kind with a feather in it, and then only at dances. A few cars were managing to move, their chains clanking. We crossed to the filling station and waited until one headed toward Colwood Mountain. Roy Lee grabbed its bumper, falling onto his sled, and one by one we formed a chain, hanging on the feet in front of us. I was the last sled. When the car pulled into the company store at 6, we let go. We trudged up the road and then set ourselves against Colwood Mountain. The snow we stepped through on the road was pristine, our tracks the first. There was good traction to it, and we were soon at the top of the mountain. We threw ourselves down on our sleds, and yodeling our delight all the way, flew down the dipping curves, slicing new double-runner tracks. We slid down Little Dayton and into Coretta. There at the church, we chained onto another car and went all the way to the Spaghetti House. Others had walked up War Mountain, and we followed their tracks. We crunched past the little houses perched precariously on the nearly vertical slope on both sides of us. Then we slid down into War. We arrived at Big Creek High at lunchtime, leaned our sleds against the wall just inside the main door, and walked in as if we were kings of the earth. Mr. Turner caught sight of us. If you boys think you're going to class, you're very much mistaken. County superintendent has suspended classes for everyone for the remainder of the day. However, please go to your teachers and get your homework before you leave. I headed for Miss Riley's room and was relieved to find her at her desk. She had asked me to stop by after school the previous day, but I had forgotten to do it. I started with an apology. I'm sorry about yesterday, Miss Riley. I must have been a sorry sight because she looked at me with sincere concern. How did you get here? When I told her, she held out her hand. Let me feel your hands. Oh, they're ice cold. You go down to the cafeteria and get some hot chocolate. I did as I was told. When I got back, she opened her desk drawer and withdrew a book. It looked to be a textbook. Its cover was red. She held it out to me. "This came in yesterday. Miss Bryson and I put our heads together and ordered it for you. Here." Miss Bryson was the librarian. I took the book and read its title, written in gold gilt on a black bar imprinted on the front cover. It was the most wondrous book title I'd ever seen. Principles of Guided Missile Design. I flipped through the pages of the book, seeing chapter titles, amazing chapter titles, passing before my eyes. Aerodynamics relating to missile design, wind tunnels and ballistic ranges, momentum theory applied to propulsion, and flow through nozzles. Then I read the most wonderful title of a chapter in any book I had ever held, Fundamentals of Rocket Engines. I reverently turned the book in my hands. "Can I keep it for a while?" "It's yours, Sonny. You can keep it forever." I felt as if she had given me something straight from God. "I don't know how to thank you," I blurted. "All I've done is given you a book. You have to have the courage to learn what's inside. Come on, you can walk me out to my car." She put on her coat, and I escorted Miss Riley down the hall, past Mr. Turner, who watched us suspiciously, and outside to the teacher's parking lot. At her car, she put her hand on my arm. "Sonny, it may take a while, but I believe you can learn the things that are in this book. Then maybe finally Quentin and I will convince you to enter the science fair." "Miss Riley, if you want me to enter, I'll do it." "When you're ready," she said. At that moment, I believed I was ready for anything just because she believed I was. On February 1st, I heard on the radio that the Russians had launched Luna 1, the first man-made object ever to break away from Earth's gravity. The velocity required for that was 25,500 miles per hour, or approximately 7 miles per second, a distance I could visualize easily because 7 miles was the distance between Colwood and Welch. The next day, the Welch Daily News said Luna 1 had missed the moon but by a mere 3,728 miles. The next time they tried, the politicians and editorial writers worried, the Russians might hit it, and then what kind of world would we live in? I worried with them. Would we never catch up to the Russians in space? Every time the United States launched a satellite, the Russians launched one bigger and better. I trusted that Wernher von Braun at least was doing something about it. In my own small way, I figured I was, too. I hurried every day after school to my desk to pore over my rocket book. On the weekend, Quentin hitched a ride across the mountain to study the book for himself. All morning he sat on the side porch and carefully, reverently turned each page, his face a frown of concentration. Finally, he said, "There's a lot of theory in here that presumes the reader already knows subjects we haven't had, chief among them, I suspect, thermodynamics and calculus. Did you note the discussion of isentropic and adiabatic flows?" I slid my chair beside him. I had skipped over the chapter he was on, titled Elementary Gas Dynamics. Its pages of equations had discouraged me, but Quentin was far from discouraged. "All of these equations lead to a discussion of what happens to a gas when it enters a flow passage. Sonny, a flow passage and a rocket nozzle are one and the same." Quentin pointed to an illustration, two trapezoids on their sides, the small ends facing one another. The figure was marked Characteristics of Flow Passage for Subsonic and Supersonic Flow Expansion and Compression. "Look, this is how a rocket nozzle works, why it's designed as it is. Did you even bother to read about De Laval nozzles?" I had at least done that. A Swedish engineer, Carl Gustav De Laval, had shown that by adding a divergent passage to a converging nozzle, one that necked down to a narrow throat, the expansion of the fluid or gas coming out of the throat would be transformed into jet kinetic energy. In other words, the gas came out of the passage faster than it went in. "So we should build," Quentin, looking smug, completed my sentence, "perfectly calculated De Laval nozzles. We do that, Sonny, my boy, and we're going to fly rockets not thousands of feet, but miles into the sky." "If we can learn how to work these equations," I said. Quentin nodded.
Yes, that will be the trick.
The next Saturday, the day clear and cold with light winds, we set AUK 16 on the pad, sliding it down the launch rod. A small group of people waited expectantly on the road. I was surprised to see some sub-debs in their distinctive leather jackets standing apart. I went over to them when I saw Valentine Carmina drop dead gorgeous in a tight black skirt and a white V-neck sweater. She looked at me mischievously.
I just had to see your rocket, Sonny. I'm glad you came, Valentine.
I was suddenly feeling very warm. Her breast had pretty much swallowed my arm. She released me and turned to study me.
Sonny, I got something to say, and I'm going to say it. I know you're crazy about that Dorothy Plunk, but she don't seem to give a flip about you. Boy, as cute as you shouldn't have to put up that.
She smiled and winked.
You should have a girl who appreciates you. Now, I ain't saying who that girl ought to be, but you need to take a look around.
Roy Lee walked up to us while I was trying to figure out what to say.
I hate to break this up. Believe me, I do, but we've got a rocket to launch.
He led me off, his hand firmly on my arm.
Now there's a woman, Sonny boy.
Then I heard Quentin whoop. He was downrange with one of the old mine telephones Odell and Roy Lee had acquired from the mule barn. We were testing them for the first time. Sherman and Odell had run phone wires all morning, hooking them up to old truck batteries donated by Emily Sue's father from his scrapyard. When I entered the blockhouse, the speaker to the phone squawked, startling me. Sherman spoke into the phone.
Blockhouse!
He listened for a moment, then yelled.
It works! It works!
We each took our turn at the phone, talking to Quentin. Roy Lee went outside and ran the BCMA flag up the pole. When he came back, I started to count, with Sherman on the phone to Quentin keeping up with me.
10, 9, 8, 7.
At zero, I touched the bare tips of the ignition wires to the battery. There was a spark as the wires touched, and then AUK 16 suddenly jumped off the pad and flew straight up the rod into the sky, a white plume of rocket candy fire and smoke sizzling behind. It had a fine contrail, allowing us to track it all the way. When the rocket was just a pinpoint in the sky, it arced over smoothly and dropped downrange. I heard a satisfactory thunk when it hit the slack. We fired three more rockets that day, 2 2-footers and 1 3-footer, counting up to AUK 19. All performed flawlessly, flying nice elliptical trajectories downrange to impact on the slack. Billy aimed his theodolite from a spot beside the blockhouse, and Quentin did the same with his downrange. Two observation points made the trig more accurate, and Quentin calculated that the 2-footers reached an altitude of around 3,000 feet, the 3-footer around 2,000 feet, an observation that confirmed our suspicions on rocket performance and their size. When going for altitude, bigger wasn't always better. A few days later, Quentin and I were called from typing class, told to report to Mr. Turner's office. Mrs. Turner, who worked as Mr. Turner's secretary, was clearly flustered. She leaped from her chair when we arrived and ushered us inside. Turning from the principal's office window were 2 uniformed men, the patches on their arms identifying them as West Virginia State Police. Mr. Turner nodded toward us.
That's them.
The state troopers were huge and daunting in their gray uniforms. One of them advanced on us holding a scorched metal tube with fins attached to it.
Recognize this, boys?
He held it out to us and we stared at it.
It's yours, isn't it? Mr. Turner accused.
Quentin recovered first.
May I inspect this device?
The trooper handed it to him, and he turned the tube over in his hands. Then he showed it to me.
Interesting, is it not? Note carefully how the fins are attached. See? They're spring-loaded. Ingenious design.
I finally found my voice.
What is it?
Mr. Turner snorted.
Oh, come, boys, tell the truth. I think you know very well what this is. It is one of your so-called rockets.
I shook my head.
No, sir, it isn't. But these fins...
I took the thing from Quentin. I wasn't certain what I was looking at, but whatever it was, I wanted to compare the area of the fins with the area of the tubing. I suspected there was knowledge there to be gained.
Can we have this?
The trooper snatched the tube back, his face clouded with anger.
No, you can't have this. It's evidence. Your rocket started a forest fire. It burned the top off Davy Mountain and almost got to the houses on Highway 52.
I remembered reading something about the fire in the Welch Daily News. There had been some speculation that it was caused by arson.
We didn't do it,
I yelped. The other trooper ignored my denial.
You're the only kids in this county who are shooting off rockets, so it has to be you.
He took out handcuffs.
Now come along, we need to take you over to Welch, to the courthouse. You are officially under arrest, both of you.
Mr. Turner walked to his desk.
There's a couple of more boys involved. I'll have them called, too.
Suddenly, Miss Riley appeared in the doorway.
Why are you scaring these boys?
She walked over and inserted herself between me and the trooper holding the handcuffs. The troopers looked surprised.
They tried to burn half the county down.
The other trooper nodded.
With this rocket.
Miss Riley confronted the troopers, hands on hips.
Where was this fire?
Davy Mountain.
Between Colwood and Welch, by the way a crow flies, or a rocket.
Mrs. Turner entered the office, holding a map of the county. She looked at her husband. He knew, and she knew he knew, that she had called Miss Riley to our rescue.
Maybe this might help.
Miss Riley spread the map on Mr. Turner's desk and motioned to me. Come over here and show us where your rocket range is. I leaned over the desk, my trembling finger finding Colwood, and then moving down the valley toward the Big Branch River, finally resting on the low place that was Cape Colwood.
Here.
The troopers looked, and then one of them slapped Davy Mountain with his big paw.
You see, only an inch away.
Miss Riley laughed.
An inch is 10 miles on this map.
Quentin had been looking at the tube. Suddenly, he exclaimed,
Of course, I should have known at the moment I saw these fins. They're spring-loaded because they have to snap out when this device leaves its storage tube.
Everyone in the principal's office turned to see what he was talking about.
It's an aeronautical flare. I thought it looked familiar. I was reading a book on the Civil Air Patrol just a month or so ago.
Quentin perused the map.
Look here. There's the Welch Airport just beside Davy Mountain. This must be a flare dropped from an airplane.
The troopers looked at the tube and then took it away from Quentin and looked at it some more, snapping the fins closed and back open again. Then they looked at one another and then at the map. Then they looked at us and then we all turned and looked at Mr. Turner, who seemed to shrink before us. Steadying himself, he carefully turned the map around and studied it through his half glasses. He straightened up and spoke quietly to the troopers.
I think you'd better leave.
As the winter of 1959 waned and the snow and ice melted, many miners who had been cut off the year before were called back to the mine. The Ohio Steel Mill had received a big order and needed coal, lots of it. For the first time in years, the company went to a 3-shift, 7-days-a-week production schedule. New cars, heavy with fins and chrome, were parked in front of miners' houses from New Camp to Frog Level, and new swing sets brightly painted erected in the backyards. Women and children wore new clothes. Living rooms glowed with new television sets, and home telephones, from the phone company, not the mine, appeared on little tables. Dad was in a frenzy every time I saw him, hopping up and down to yell into the black telephone, running up to the mine in the middle of the night. Mom kept working on her painting in the kitchen. She was putting in a house on the beach. About the same time, a strange traffic began at my home. College football coaches come to entice Jim to their schools. Despite his fears, the year's suspension had not dimmed his reputation. I was banished from the living room when they came, but listened all the same, sitting on the steps in the darkened foyer.
For heaven's sakes, Homer, remain calm,
I heard Mom tell Dad in the kitchen when the coaches from West Virginia University were there.
You're going to have a heart attack.
Do you realize who's in our house, woman? He demanded.
He loaded up a tray of glasses of iced tea and rushed back to the living room, glancing my way as he passed. He had a huge grin on his face, but it disappeared at the sight of me. I must have looked particularly unhappy.
And what's with you? He asked warily.
My grades weren't good enough to get into calculus class.
I told him the story quickly because I could see how eager he was to get back to the coaches. I had gone to Mr. Turner to request a special calculus class for the six of us who wanted to learn the math and the rocket book. Mr. Turner was reluctant at first, but after the debacle in his office with the state troopers, he had acquiesced. A special calculus class with space for six students, no more, was to be formed. But seven students